It's that magical time again, the Olympics. As American gymnast Mary Lou Retton once said, for athletes, the Olympics are the ultimate test of their worth. Which I think is completely true. When we watch the Olympics, we are seeing the very boundaries of what the human body is capable of. From weightlifting to basketball and everything in between, the Olympic Games offer the very best of the best. However, I think there is even more to these games than simply a showcase of athleticism. My name is Josh, and this is Obscure History. We all love the Olympics, right? I mean, I do. And even if you don't love the Olympics, I'm almost certain that you at least know about them and probably have some memories of the games. For me, I always remember keeping a tally sheet of the medals each country won. My grandma would help me sort through it, especially when a tiny country that I hadn't heard of medaled. It's a really fun memory, and I look forward to carrying on that tradition as my boys get old enough to care about such things. The Olympics have been around for thousands of years. Every 4 years, a series of athletic contests were held at the sanctuary of Zeus in Olympia, Greece. These games were of high religious significance, and sacrifices were offered to Zeus right alongside the athletic contests, which included sports like running, boxing, wrestling, various throwing contests, jumping, and even equestrian events like chariot racing. These games were actually of such significance to the ancient Greeks that they used the games as a measurement of time, calling a span of 4 years an Olympiad. While the inception date of the games and their true origin are somewhat mysterious, our best guess is that the games started sometime around 776 BCE, as an inscription on the sanctuary of Zeus lists a man named Choroebus, who was a baker and a cook, as the first champion in that year. While Choroebus and the ancient Greek champions that followed him did receive a prize, the renown gained from winning the games was far more desirable. Choroebus went from being a humble baker to a man immortalized in paintings, verse, and song all throughout ancient Greece. And with his victory, Choroebus kick-started an era of dominance for athletes from Elis. Similar to the modern Olympic Games, the ancient Greek Games were composed of athletic representatives from all of ancient Greece's city-states. In fact, there is sort of a myth surrounding these early games. You may have heard that ancient Greece put all of its wars on hold to host the games, and that the games represented a sort of temporary peace. That's not really true at all, actually, but those who wished to make a pilgrimage to the sanctuary of Zeus for the games and sacrifices were allowed to pass through warring territories without fear of harm, as the Olympic truce, as it has been called in modern history, protected them from accidentally being swept up in a skirmish. But even though the Olympic truce is mostly a myth, or rather a dramatically misunderstood fact, I think that it's totally reasonable that modern viewers have made that association. There is a sense of universal brotherhood when we watch the Olympics, isn't there? Like, maybe for a moment the tensions and bloodshed held between two countries could be put on hold for the sake of nothing more than a friendly athletic contest. This year it feels like every country is participating against a backdrop of severe loss and stress at the hands of COVID-19. But further, you've got Israel and Palestine competing in the same games. China and its tenuous relationship with, frankly, the entire Western world at the moment, and the abrupt departure of North Korea from the games due to COVID-19 concerns. I actually read an article recently that South Korean politicians were disappointed to learn of North Korea's exit because they were hoping that the games would rekindle peace talks. Though the idea that the Olympic Games urge the world into a temporary ceasefire might be sort of a modern mythologizing of a somewhat obscure fact, it seems to be at least a powerful placebo. And honestly, that's why I care about the Olympics. even though they are just games, and even though it doesn't really affect a country if they win or lose the games, I still find it so fascinating that we have this moment every 4 years, or two if you count the Winter Olympics, where people who were mere weeks ago at war with each other now have to at least feign civility in front of the entire planet. A lot of the time, it really works, too. People regain faith in humanity by watching these nations participate in a singular activity, despite their political proclivities otherwise. I think that this speaks to our humanity. Wars are fought by people. When we strip away the armor and disarm the weapons, what's left? People. The athlete from Israel has the same heartbeat as the athlete from Palestine. They have the same basic needs and wants, and in my personal opinion, they share the same curse. The people who participate in war are often having their very existence manipulated by people who they will never meet, to satisfy goals that will never benefit them. That's why I watch the Olympics, because for a couple of weeks, I can see through those invisible borders and I'm reminded that humans are humans, regardless of which flag controls their fate. Maybe you don't see it that way, and it's fine if you don't. Perhaps I'm embellishing because that's what good authors do, or maybe I'm just sensitive. Frankly, both of those are true. However, I can't look past the times when not even the magic of the Olympic Games was enough to turn rifles into plowshares. You see, there was one Olympic event that was very much a reflection of the political strife held between two countries. The year was 1956, and the world was still reeling from the catastrophic disaster that was World War II. It's not often remembered, but the Axis powers consisted of more than just Germany, Italy, and Japan. The kingdoms of Romania, Bulgaria, and Thailand allied themselves with the Axis powers, as well as the Slovak Republic, the Republic of Finland, the independent state of Croatia, and the Kingdom of Hungary. Each of those countries had their own reasons for joining forces with the bad guys. And yes, this is one of, if not the only major war in history where a moral line in the sand can be drawn without debate. For Hungary, much like the others, the decision came from a place of deep insecurity. Like Germany, Hungary had seen a few years of bad luck as a result of post-war sanctions and a generally unstable government. Adolf Hitler made the same promise to Hungary and the other minor Axis powers as he did the German people. If you just get on board with my plan, I'll restore you to the superpower you once were. There was also a very real threat of being run over by that train if you declined the offer. Also, the Hungarian government already shared Hitler's anti-Semitism before they even began discussions. There are times when we study history when we're tasked with researching the very worst humanity has to offer. It's depressing, and it's difficult, but here's something that I find very important to state. If you are studying history, you do not ever have to sympathize with the Axis powers, and you should never do so. History is an interpretive field, but anyone who commits genocide is beyond your sympathy. It's critical to forming a functioning historical narrative to understand why those people decided to do the things that they did, but understanding and sympathizing are completely different things. After the war, Hungary found itself in the same position as many Eastern European countries did, staring down the Red Army and Joseph Stalin. For those countries, the war never really ended. The enemies and objectives merely changed. As the Soviet Union reclaimed countries like Poland and Hungary from Nazi control, they then assumed power, and in many ways, Stalin's Russia was a lateral movement from Hitler's Germany. As a satellite state of the Soviet Union, Hungary faced some of the same troubles it sought to avoid by joining forces with the Axis powers in the first place. From 1949 to 1956, an estimated 2,000 people were executed and over 100,000 were imprisoned. Some 44,000 ended up in forced labor camps where many died due to horrible work conditions, poor food, and a lack of medical care. Another 15,000 people, mostly upper class, were deported from the capital to other cities in the countryside where they were forced to perform hard agricultural labor. In total, in less than a decade, it is estimated that 200,000 people were persecuted by Soviet-sympathizing secret police. On top of a suffocating and violent government, the Hungarian economy took a massive hit after the war. As a result of the war, Hungary had to make hundreds of millions of dollars worth of reparation payments. This caused the Hungarian economy to completely fold. The only way that the Hungarian people were able to continue was to accept help from Soviet-backed economic programs, which only embedded the Stalin regime deeper into the country's government. But as history has taught us, oppression often does not last forever. In 1953, Stalin died, and with his death, a new wave of more moderate government began slithering its way through the Eastern European countries. Stalin's puppet in Hungary, Matyas Rákosi, stepped down, and the Hungarian people began to sense a chip in the armor of the government that had violently held them down for nearly a decade. Students, writers, and journalists were the first to begin speaking up. They formed clubs to discuss revolutionary ideas. They conspired with each other to organize demonstrations and protests. They wrote articles. They made demands. They looked to their history to inspire change. On October 23, 1956, 20,000 people gathered around a statue of Joseph Bem, a political hero of Poland and Hungary. The crowd began to embolden after the reading of a manifesto by the president of the Writers' Union. They chanted political poems which had been censored for nearly a decade. They sang patriotic songs. The words, this we swear, we will no longer be slaves, rose from their throats and filled the air with the spirit of revolution. Somebody in the crowd cut the communist emblem out of the Hungarian flag and hoisted it aloft, a hole now in the center. Others followed suit, and the crowd began to move on the parliament building, cutting the communist emblem out of every Hungarian flag they could find, still singing songs of revolution. By the time they reached the parliament building, the 20,000 protesters had turned into a writhing crowd of 200,000 people desperate to take control of their freedom. 200,000 people who had been tormented by secret police and exclusionary legislation. 200,000 people who were demanding change. The secretary of the ruling party, Ernie Giro, broadcast his condemnation of the demonstrators and refused to satiate any of their demands. It was at this moment that the protest turned into a revolution. The crowd, which had been largely peaceful before, turned destructive. They toppled a 30-foot-tall statue of Stalin and danced on his broken pieces. They stormed a radio station in hopes of broadcasting their manifesto and list of demands. However, police had already heavily fortified the radio station. Gunshots rang out, and the first casualties of the Hungarian Revolution of 1956 were recorded. The 200,000 demonstrators were now revolutionaries, and their protest was now a fight for survival. Guns were seized from military depots and distributed amongst the freedom fighters. Police cars were set on fire, and many of the soldiers who were sent to the riot to quell the rebellion instead tore the communist emblem from their uniform and joined the crowd. Sensing his power quickly coming to an end, Ernie Giro called to request aid from the Soviet military to squash the uprising, and they jumped right in. Only 2 days after the revolution had started, Soviet tanks rolled into Budapest. Pro-communist troops took pot shots at revolutionaries from the rooftops. Soviet tanks bombarded Budapest, and Soviet fighter jets literally bombed civilians. The army of brothers, bakers, mothers, veterans, and children fought Soviet steel with handmade Molotov cocktails and an arsenal of stolen weapons. The revolution ground to a standstill after only a few days of fighting. The bodies of hundreds of civilians, pro-communist soldiers, and Soviet troops littered the streets of Budapest. Buildings that once held eager students, merchants, or sick patients in need of care were reduced to smoldering, blistered scars, the growing pains of freedom. While the people of Hungary fought for their freedom, the Hungarian water polo team watched from high atop a mountain training camp. They could see the smoke rising from their homes, and they could hear the bombs splitting through brick and steel. They could only sit and watch and pray that their loved ones were safe. And from that vantage point, they could see that the force behind this violence was a familiar foe, the Soviet Union. I do not want to stop for an ad break, but I have to. So if you don't mind, sit tight for about 1 minute. I'm going to play a couple of messages from our sponsors, and when we get back, I'll get into exactly how insane this story gets. This episode was brought to you in part by the Disastrous History Podcast. There is, like, an infinite amount of things to study when we look at the past, and something that I really do not see investigated all that often is the history of disasters, both natural and man-made. Disastrous History is fresh. It is just starting out. I think that they're about 25 episodes in, and honestly, kind of reminds me of my early episodes, and I mean that in the most complimentary way possible. I think that if you enjoy this show, you are going to definitely enjoy Disastrous History. So I'm going to link their show in my show notes. If that at all sounds interesting to you, you're going to want to get in on this thing while it's still small, and you can become a part of that community, because I have a feeling that this show has the potential to take off any day now. Again, that's the Disastrous History Podcast, covering the history of disasters. While Hungary was deep in the midst of a violent revolution, Melbourne, Australia was hard at work preparing to host the 1956 Olympic Games. Though going to compete in the Olympic Games in Australia sounds like a blast, there were actually 8 countries that were boycotting the Games for various reasons. Egypt, Iraq, Cambodia, and Lebanon announced that they would not participate in the Olympics in response to the Suez Crisis, where Egypt was invaded by Israel, the UK, and France. The Netherlands, Spain, and Switzerland were boycotting the events in protest of the Soviet invasion of Hungary, and the People's Republic of China chose to boycott the event because Taiwan had been allowed to compete. And frankly, that still seems completely on brand. And on top of the geopolitical tensions going on around the 1956 Games, there was also a healthy amount of internal tension within the Olympic Committee. Though Melbourne had won the voting to be the host city, there were a ton of complications. An equine quarantine completely eliminated any equestrian events from the Melbourne site, and as such, Stockholm, Sweden was selected as an alternative site for those specific events. Australian politicians who were facing very real economic problems like a severe housing crisis constantly fought about funding for the Games, and in fact, this quarreling over the funds nearly prevented the Olympic Village from being built at all. Construction was so far behind schedule that the Olympic Committee reached out to Rome, who was pegged to host the 1960 Games, just to see if they happened to be ready 4 years in advance. Perhaps in all of this drama and stress, the event organizers just happened to overlook the fact that, maybe, Hungary and the USSR would square off in a game of water polo. The 1956 Hungarian water polo team was no joke. They were the defending Olympic champions, and they had every intention of retaining that title. Once they had seen the invasion of Hungary by the Soviets, they secreted themselves away to Czechoslovakia as to not be caught up in the revolution. By the time the Games had started, the revolution had been completely snuffed out and the Soviets were maintaining a strong presence in Hungary. The Hungarian athletes at the Games saw them as an opportunity to salvage some of that revolutionary spirit. The crowd in attendance for the Hungary vs. USSR water polo match was almost completely Hungarian expatriates who were already pumped full of adrenaline after having just come from watching Hungarian boxer Laszlo Papp defend his championship. The USSR team didn't know going into the match, but they were walking right into the lion's den. As the superior team and far and away favorites for the match, the Hungarian team probably didn't need to do a ton of game planning for this particular match. But that morning, they had a team meeting and made some decisions. The game plan was to taunt the Russians in their own language. The Hungarian team decided to say the worst possible things they could think of. In a very sweet moment of cosmic irony, they were able to do this because they were forced to learn Russian as children under the oppressive Soviet regime. The teams were finally ready to take the pool. For those who are not familiar, water polo is a bit like soccer, but in a very deep pool. Like soccer, you've got two teams trying to put a ball into the opposing team's goal, but unlike soccer, water polo is a contact sport. I swam competitively for a few years when I was a teenager, and we would occasionally get to play water polo instead of doing our regular practice for special occasions. At the time, I was a very strong swimmer, and I literally felt like I was going to drown when I played water polo. It's extremely taxing physically. Just the act of sprinting to grab the ball, treading water to aim, and then propelling yourself out of the water enough to get some power into your throw is just completely draining. But on top of all of that physical strain, you've got other people trying to dunk you under the water and rip the ball out of your hand. Don't get me wrong, it was a ton of fun, but water polo can get pretty hairy even among friends, let alone bitter enemies. The Hungarians and Russians got into position. The referee started the match, and things immediately deteriorated. The Hungarians' plan to taunt the Russians into sloppy play worked. And even further, it taunted the Russians into violent play, and that's just what the Hungarians were hoping for. From the very beginning of the match, the teams began exchanging punches, kicks, and some players even held their opponents underwater in headlocks. With every blow landed by the Hungarians, the crowd erupted with cheers. When Soviet players were sent to the penalty box, they were bombarded with slurs and curses, all in Russian, tinged with a bitter Hungarian accent. When Hungarian players were sent to the penalty box, they were cheered and glorified. Star of the game, Ervin Zadar, told reporters later that there was fighting above and below the water. The Hungarians went ahead on the scoreboard and never looked back. With each goal, the Russians got more angry and more sloppy, leaving better opportunities open for the Hungarians. Ervin Zadar tallied 2 goals out of the 4 total scored by the Hungarians, and the Russians were completely shut out. Toward the end of the game, a Russian player named Valentin Propakov snuck a sucker punch in on Zadar, and that's when the already immensely violent match nearly turned into a riot. Recalling the incident, Zadar said, "A whistle came, I looked at the referee, and I said, 'What's the whistle for?' And the moment I did that, I knew I'd made a horrible mistake. I turned back, and with a straight arm, he smacked me in the face. He tried to punch me out. I saw about 4,000 stars, and I reached to my face, and I felt warm blood pouring out, and I said, 'Oh my God, I won't be able to play in the next game.'" And he was right. Blood was gushing from his face. He was pulled out of the pool by referees, and the crowd exploded. People jumped out of the stands and ran into the swimming pool area and began swarming the Russian team, spitting at them, swinging fists at them, and screaming the worst Russian words that they knew. The police immediately intervened and broke up the crowd. The match was called despite actually not running for the set duration, and the referees made an executive decision to award the victory to Hungary as they were ahead at the time of the riot, and everyone was ushered out of the pool complex as quickly as possible. Having secured an important victory, the Hungarian team had to look ahead to their next match against the Yugoslavian team. However, Zador's initial suspicions were correct. He would have to watch the gold medal game from the sidelines. As soon as the photo of Zadar standing at the edge of the pool, blood gushing down his face, dazed look in his eye, made its way to Western media, it was dubbed the Blood in the Water match, and the news spread like wildfire.
Water polo. First of the 3 sports to be conducted in Melbourne's new Olympic swimming pool was water polo. 10 nations entered teams, and as expected, the European countries were strongly represented. This match is a final round contest between the ultimate winners, Hungary, and the third place getters, Russia. Hungary with the white caps. Of the whole series, this was the most vigorously contested game, and ended with Hungary's forward leaving the pool injured. The expected six teams reach the final round, namely the three favorites, Hungary, Yugoslavia, and Russia, and Italy, America, and Germany. But on performances, there was little doubt that the gold medal would go to either Hungary or to Yugoslavia. Meeting Russia's forcing play with clever tactical moves, Hungary and the White Caps were clearly the masters in this game. One fierce encounter resulted in 21-year-old Hungarian Ervin Zador sustaining a badly cut eyebrow. For a few moments, both public and player feeling ran very hot. But as several internationals later pointed out, water polo has always been a game of hard clashes, and at times injuries inevitably must occur. Hungary won that match 4-0.
Of course, there were some embellishments. Some news outlets alleged that the pool had turned red from all of the blood shed between these two heated rivals. That's obviously not true, but the sentiment is. These two teams used the Olympics to resolve a very real, very personal conflict. While it's generally the case that the Olympics offer a sort of reprieve from war and battle, in the case of the blood in the water match, it only provided an additional battlefield. A place where a crushed revolution could live on, where, in front of a national audience, the Hungarian people could feel a sense of justice. Though they couldn't force the Soviet tanks out of the streets of Budapest, they forced the Soviet water polo team into submission. Obviously, it's not equivalent, but it's important. Moral victories on the sports field can turn into very real momentum for a struggling community. After the 1956 games, many players from the Hungarian water polo team defected to the West. For Ervin Zador, the man who stole the spotlight in the blood in the water match, he settled down in Northern California and found his calling as a swim coach. In fact, he coached a teenage Mark Spitz who would go on to become one of the most celebrated Olympic athletes of all time. Unfortunately, it would take another 30 years before Hungary could shake off the yoke of communism. Despite receiving significant international aid in the immediate aftermath of the 1956 revolution attempt. But freedom did eventually come, and those revolutionaries, both in the streets of Budapest and the waters of Melbourne, have been immortalized in Hungarian history as the brave few who took a stand when it could have cost them everything. All right, guys, that is the end of this wild ride. Thank you for listening today. I sincerely appreciate all of you, and I really do hope that you find a way to watch some of the Olympics. I still very much enjoy watching the games, and I hope that if you do, you can figure out the weird schedule, because frankly, between all of NBC's, like, five different apps, I'm having a bit of a hard time keeping up, which is a disappointment, because I do really like the games. So, I do have a favor to ask of you before you go. I'm going to put the link, I'm putting a link to a survey in the show notes of this episode. If you would not mind taking that survey, I would really appreciate it. It is anonymous. I'm not going to get your email or your name or your phone number or anything like that. It's just a very basic demographic snapshot, because as I try to legitimize this show, a lot of the time advertisers want to know things like, what gender are my listeners usually, or what do they do for a living, or, you know, things like that, just very basic information. Some of that information is available to me through, like, my hosts. Some of it is not. So if you wouldn't do that for me, that'd be pretty rad. I mean, it's kind of a pain, but it would help me out a lot as I try to sort of open up some new avenues for this show. Also, don't forget the Disastrous History Podcast. Their link is going to be down there as well. And as we wrap things up, I am super stoked to present American Actor and their song Boomer Friends. I absolutely love this track. I'm so pumped that they submitted their song to be an indie feature on this show. Their music reminds me, I swear, there's going to be like three of you that get this reference, and if you do, email me at obscurehistorypod@gmail.com or DM me on social media, because I want to know who you are. Their music reminds me a lot of Jawbreaker or maybe Jets to Brazil, which are two of my favorite, like, alternative 90s punk proto emo bands. Like, This track is big, it's got attitude, and it's fun. I imagine this song being totally electric live. Like, I see like a couple hundred sweaty people jammed into the basement of a record store, just like losing their minds to this song. And I would pay a fistful of money to be there for that, because I think it would be a wonderful show. So definitely check out American Actors. I'm going to put their, I'm going to put a link to some of their stuff in the bio as or the bio, the show notes as well. And definitely, if you like this song, find these guys on social media. Make sure that you follow them, because if you want to see a live band, I have a funny feeling that these guys are probably killer to listen to live. So anyways, thank you so much for listening, guys. If you like this show, I always forget these things that I'm supposed to say. If you like this episode, share it with your friends, rate it, review it on iTunes. That helps me like weirdly a lot. And yeah, just continue to have a nice week, I hope. Okay, I'm going to get out of here before I like completely lose my mind rambling on. I hope that you have a nice week. I'm leaving. I got to go to bed so I can go to work tomorrow. See you next week. The world is